sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Big tech earnings flop. Bank of Japan hints at more stimulus. Massive week coming for economic and earnings and the markets. We have a couple of listener questions and our guest today, Jack Schwager. He's going to tell us about Fund Seeder and about his experience interviewing the world's best traders. All this and much more on episode number 460 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And a good day, fine howdy do to you. It's Andrew Horowitz and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together each and every week. Talk about a whole host of different ideas, topics, speak with some of the greatest traders and investment minds on the planet, talking about things ranging from, well, simply technical analysis to fundamental analysis to the world at large, economies, central banks, and everything in between. So today we're going to have a pretty good show. As I mentioned, a guest that we've had on before who is the author of the very popular book series called Market Wizards, but he has something else he was telling me about, and I thought it would be very interesting for him to come on and explain to you and to me at the same time all about his new project called Fund Seeder. That's Jack Schwager coming up in a little bit, and we do have some listener questions that I'll get to after I speak to Jack. In the meantime, we have to talk about what happened last week, because a lot of things did. We'll start off with some of the economics that we saw. Well, from last month to this month, interestingly enough, we saw that there was a big drop, if you remember, last month in the existing home sales. Well, they were up about 5.5% this month. So again, noisy items that you have to average out over time, looking at several different months together to see what the trend is. Trend is still pretty strong for the housing markets overall. That's good. Now, we did also see that the median price of houses, according to the National Association of Realtors, was at $222,700, which is about 5.5% higher than a year ago. So that's also good, seeing that continual trend of higher prices in general for houses on average. And that's also good because this wealth effect, the idea that the more money that you and I have in the value of our home, in our wallet, in the value of our 401k investment accounts, etc., makes us so much happier. Can't complain about that, right? Can't argue either. That what happens is it will instill confidence in us as consumers to go out and buy things, to maybe buy a bigger house, possibly to remodel, maybe even to buy more clothes, or maybe to buy a new car, maybe to buy just a new TV, something out there that will stimulate the economy. The whole idea of this wealth effect that the Fed has been really promoting for the last 6 or 7, 8 years is all about the idea that we want to make sure that people have enough money to feel comfortable and confident that they can go out and stimulate the economy on their own. So it's an indirect way that they are trying to push asset values higher across the board through lower interest rates and all other methodologies, inclusive QE and all that, to try to actually bring up the value of our wealth. We know that's been working, but there was a bit of a glitch when it came to the lack of overall demand, but really the oversupply with oil and other commodities outside of the U.S. primarily, that really put a kibosh on the whole inflation process, which is what the Fed also is intending on doing. You know, if you think about it for a second, if we just think about what we just talked about, how when you have the wealth effect, it makes you feel better. When you feel better, maybe you'll buy more. When you buy more, there's more demand. More demand means that obviously it will press on prices and keep prices moving higher because the demand is continuing to rise as well. And then you get inflation. But something backfired along the way because we're not the only ones applying the stimulus. And because of the currency moves and because of the fact that we're seeing that around the world there's crazy things going on with negative interest rates, which the Bank of Japan hinted just within 30 minutes of the close of the Japanese Nikkei market on Friday that, yeah, well, maybe we'll do some of that. Even though 2 or 3 weeks ago, they said, no, we're not going to do that. No more negative rates. We're not going to move further into that until we see how things go. And markets were not doing really well. This big news of really pretty awful earnings from the big tech giants that hit on the tape Thursday evening here in the U.S. And that was spilling over into the rest of the world as a very concerning factor. Well, I guess the Bank of Japan decided, you know what? What the heck? Throw a little Hail Mary here. And maybe we can revive markets if we say that maybe there is some more stimulus coming. Not sure that we're really telling you straight what the story is, but we're going to try to do what we can to keep markets afloat for a couple more days at least. So the, it's funny because Kuroda, who is the Bank of Japan speaker and the head of the Bank of Japan in terms of the equivalent of Janet Yellen in Japan, it's almost like he has a radio show that is on throughout the market hours in Japan. It's kind of crazy, but almost every day he's saying something. Ah, we'll add a little stimulus. Well, maybe we're not going to put more stimulus out there. Nope, no more negative rates. Okay, the next day there is going to be negative rates. And almost every single day there's something that comes out of Kuroda. It's like he's just trying to massage and move and kind of bend the markets in the direction that he wants to. Don't forget something. This is really important here. The Bank of Japan now owns close to 40 or 50% of the ETFs in the Japanese markets on the open market. They are buyers of securities on the open market. Now, obviously, it would behoove them to say what they can to try to rev up market values because their balance sheet will grow and be benefited by the asset prices moving up as well, right? Doesn't that make sense? Now, what's also interesting is there were some recent studies and some commentary released over the weekend that showed actually how much the Bank of Japan owns in terms of the publicly traded companies in Japan. And one of the things that's really fascinating is that they have been buying so much that approximately 10% of the outstanding values of each of the companies on average that are publicly traded in Japan on the Japanese markets are owned by the Bank of Japan. Central Bank owns the shares. They do not have to have requirements really to limit their buys, or they have no requirements to put in advance notice of when they're going to buy, like a hedge fund would or an institution would or a mutual fund or et cetera. There's no limitation on the amount that they could buy. Kind of interesting, isn't it? The rules don't apply to them. Because why? It's in the public interest. In a way, if you think about it just for a moment, if the Bank of Japan has an unlimited money source due to the creation of yen, and they are buying into the markets directly through ETFs and who knows else how they're doing it, but if they're buying so much of the publicly traded companies, first of all, those people that are in those publicly traded companies are pretty much like working for the central bank now. I mean, it's almost like socialized investing, whereas the central bank will come along and buy all the shares. The second thing is that if you think about it just for a moment, just step back and say, okay, so what should I do? Well, you should maybe buy along with them. Why and how can the Japanese markets ever drop if backstopping them on a continual basis because of their quantitative easing and their asset purchase program, they are buying with both hands and both feet? But there's something not quite right because we do see these big drops that happen from time to time. So it looks to me like they are the pretty much the sole force of liquidity in the Japanese markets. And when they stop buying, things don't do so well. We're going to have to keep a quick watch on that, a tight watch on that, I should say, because I think that something is a little bit strange when it comes to the Japanese markets. It doesn't seem to me like that is a recipe for success over long haul for companies to be not only doing share buybacks, but then the central banks to be purchasing stock directly as well. I don't know how you feel about that. You can always write me, by the way. Send me a note at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Tell me what you think about that, because I think the Japanese market is so screwed up and so uneven, unbalanced, and really just a mess that it's not something that's going to play out well long term. Short term, it could be fine. But long term, there's some big problems there. Now, as we mentioned before, and we'll get back to some economics here, when we talked about the home sales on existing doing a lot better, seems that both housing starts and building permits decline. So again, it's a messy and noisy kind of number when it comes to this new homes, existing homes, permits, and housing starts. It's weather related. It could be just a lot of people piled in because they thought interest rates were going higher. So what they did was they locked in earlier and they bought a house. I mean, there's a lot of different things that could happen that rolls from period to period. Again, on average, things are okay there. The interesting thing about last week, though, I think the two things, in terms of the overall markets, was that number one, oil climbed again for the week. Even with no deal in Doha, the OPEC and non-OPEC meeting that came together that basically ended with no resolution to limit production or to freeze production, didn't seem to bother oil. As a matter of fact, oil closed at about 43.75, which is up about 5% for the week. Gasoline futures were also up about 5% per week for the week. And I think this is a third week in a row. The one big thing was the declining production. Here in the United States, one of the things that we know that was happening was that the rig count was down for some time. Each and every week over the last however many weeks it's been, a long time, the rig count has been down, production has been down, and slowing. Now, there was probably peak production about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And all of a sudden, we started to turn the corner here where production started to slow. That started to bring up prices. The problem is that many of these companies need their production to be high in order to make sure they have enough income to provide for payment of their various debt and obligations. Not to mention the general operations and of the company on a day-to-day basis. Very important to be watching this right now because, you know, there's going to be a sweet spot, maybe let's say 50-ish, where they can slow down production but keep their revenue stream coming in. But until we get a bit higher, this is an interesting zone right now that we're in because it could cause a lot more failures to be coming out of all this if oil doesn't really break from here. We'll see what happens with it. It's very interesting how oil is all of a sudden turning around the other corner. We're seeing this big rise. And a lot of it has to do with the short sellers that are being squeezed and the fact that, you know, obviously there's some hope that in the future there is going to be something done to limit some of this production. And as we've said, the decline in production recently has moved this up nicely. The Dow did close above 18,000 for the week, just barely, 18,003.75. The S&P was up above 2,100 for a little while there, closed at 2,091. And the NASDAQ was down for the week, closing in at 4,906. Now, before we get to our guest, I'm going to mention some of the things that are coming up this week that I want you to know about. Then we're going to talk about some of the questions that came in from some listeners. But let's talk about what's going to happen. Monday, March new home sales, earnings from Express Scripts and Halliburton. Tuesday, we're going to see the Consumer Confidence Index, the February Case-Shiller Home Price Index, earnings. It's going to be a bigger day. We have Apple, 3M, AT&T Capital One, Chipotle, Coach, eBay, Freeport-McMoRan, HealthSouth, Ingersoll Rand, JetBlue, Office Depot, Panera, Procter & Gamble, T-Mobile, Twitter, U.S. Steel, Whirlpool, and Wynn Resorts. Now, if you look last week when you did see that the Las Vegas Sands numbers came out, Las Vegas itself was one of those weakest spots around the world in terms of their revenue and their earnings. We'll see what's going to happen with Wynn. Now, on Wednesday, a Federal Reserve policy statement is going to be coming out. Pending home sales was going to be coming out with earnings from Ameriprise, BlackRock, Cheesecake Factory, Facebook, Dr. Pepper Schnepple, Garmin, Goodyear, Hilton, Marriott, PayPal, and Texas Instruments. Now, on Thursday, we have the first estimate of GDP by the BEA, and we're going to see earnings from Aetna, Altria, Amazon, big week here, Baidu, Beazer Homes, Bristol-Myers, Coca-Cola, Actually, Coca-Cola. That's a different Coca-Cola. I'm sorry. That came out last week, Coke. What else do we have? ConocoPhillips, Dunkin' Brands, Domino's, Expedia, Ford, LinkedIn, MasterCard, Pandora, Raytheon, Time Warner. And let's see here. That's it for the day that looks big. Western Digital also. Friday, University of Michigan. Final April sentiment, which has been a little bit lower than in previous months. We're going to see personal spending figures, which I'm going to be watching, and earnings from Chevron, ExxonMobil, Phillips 66, and Royal Caribbean Cruises. That's going to be a big week overall. These are the highlights. There's a lot more that will be out there as well. But it's going to be a big week. It's interesting that we noticed last week, towards the end of the week, as we mentioned, there was a real big disappointment by some of the big boys like Google, Microsoft, Visa, for that matter. And the NASDAQ was down. The S&P was flat. The small caps were up. Kind of an interesting scenario. Small caps have been following oil these days. You know, a lot of the oil companies have gone into the small cap universe, and also healthcare has been helping much of the small cap universe of late. But it was really interesting to watch this bifurcation of markets on Friday, where the NASDAQ was down at one point about 1.7% or something like that. Did come back a bit, the NASDAQ 100 that was, with the big names like Microsoft and Google, et cetera. Facebook was down, Apple was down. But we're definitely seeing a lot more expectations and disappointment off of those from an earnings perspective from many of the big players. The banks did better because earnings expectations were so incredibly low. But still, those expectations were not really cut back for many of the big boys and caused a major problem. Microsoft had one of the worst days it's had in years, down 8% after earnings. Google down about 5.5%, I believe it was, after earnings. And really some concern about the outlook from both of those companies. So it's going to be an interesting place to watch how we really move into the rest of earnings season moving ahead. So let's take a moment. We're going to get to our guest here. And then when we get back, again, have a couple questions from JC and Ron, which we'll answer. And our guest today is Jack Schwager. Now, he's been on the show many times before, and I know the audience loves Jack, talks about some amazing things. He's the author of the incredibly well-acclaimed Market Wizard series. He also is an expert in futures and hedge funds and author of all sorts of different books, as well as has some things that we're going to talk to you about today. In fact, the newest venture, I think it's the newest venture, is Fund Seeder. We'll talk about that in a minute. Jack, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks, Andrew.
So I wanted to start just for a moment, just to backtrack a little bit. I know we want to talk about this Fund Seeder, but I want to talk about the Market Wizard series. And you have a whole bunch of them out there. And for those people who have not read this book series, it really chronicles some of the best traders in the world, the you know, how they do what they do, their inside secrets and things that maybe made them very successful. And Jack had the opportunity to spend time with them over a number of years. I mean, how long is it spanning back, the first book?
Well, first book, the interviews were done in 1988. Mm-hmm. Book came out in 89. So we're over a quarter of a century.
Wow. Okay. Now, some of the things that you learned in these books, I mean, was there a common theme that you learned from these market wizards?
Yeah, there's tons of them. And of course, really, when you get right down to it, that's what I was trying to do in the books, is really figure out why these guys are different from us and why do they do so much better and what are they doing and why are they successful and, you know, all those questions. And that's really what makes up the book. All of those. And there were four of the interview style type books. There are a lot of common denominators, and we, you know, we could spend 10 hours talking about all the common denominators, but just to throw out a few, the one point I always like to make, because people miss it, is that the one unifying factor among all these people was how different their approaches were. And so doing a project like I did, it cures you of the illusion that there is some one method or secret of how to do the market, trade the markets, and it's completely not true. There are tons of different ways. Many of them seem at the surface totally contradictory, but what they have in common is that they're right for the person using it. You know, so you could have guys I interviewed like Rogers who think technical analysis is a bunch of black magic, and guys like Schwartz who will tell you how they spent their career doing fundamental analysis, lost money all the time, and got rich as technicians. So you've got polar opposites across the across the spectrum of traders, but they each kind of found what worked for them. And the other thing that makes it work, that's almost always essential, is that it's combined with risk control, risk management. So people find an approach that works for them, and it can take many years until they actually figure it out and get comfortable and find where their edge is. But once they do, in order for that to succeed, that's not enough. In order for that to succeed, they've got to pay, in their own words, they'll tell you, they pay more attention to not losing money. By not losing, I don't mean not losing on any trades. They understand that you're going to lose on a certain percentage of trades. That's a given. By not losing, paying attention on not losing, I mean by not losing too much on any single trade, by not endangering their stake. In other words, preservation of capital. So by combining a rigorous preservation of capital with a methodology that works for them, and it could be anything, that's sort of the secret sauce, if there is one. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole bunch of other traits, but that's the core of it.
You know, it's interesting because when I think about the comment you just made about not losing on a particular trade, let's say, and obviously it may be a lot of different trades that go into making up a period, a month, a year, 10-year history, of course, of a track record. But one of the things that's always fascinated is when you find these hedge fund managers that have consistent returns and performance over a period of time, let's say, 10 years or something like that. And then you have, let's say like 20%, annual compounded rate of return over a period of years. There's got to be some risk taking on that, right?
Yeah. Well, it, of course, it varies tremendously. Now, it's an interesting point you make. You will find hedge fund managers sometimes who have like very consistent returns. And they're real. I'm not talking like Madoff type, where they were consistent because he made them up. Yeah, anybody can do that. But I'm talking about people that have very consistent returns for a length of time and with a significant amount of, not a tremendous amount of return, but with a pretty respectable amount of return. One cautionary note there is a lot of those people are doing stuff where they're basically selling insurance in the marketplace. And that's fine as long as there's no insurance events to pay off. Mm-hmm. So, there are strategies where people are implicitly short volatility, let's say. Let's say somebody who began, let's say, in 2009, we're in 2016. Imagine somebody came along and first quarter 2009 started a strategy where all they did is continually sold puts and calls out of the market.
Right.
And that's all they did. And, well out of the market. And they'd be collecting money left and right. Once in a while, they'd have a bit of a drawdown, but nothing major because really haven't had a, real big negative market. Mm-hmm. So their record is going to look pretty, pretty consistent and, very consistent and pretty darn good. However, if you get another type of 2008, not only do they, strategies like, you don't even have to get a 2008, you get a half of a 2008.
Yeah.
That type of strategy doesn't simply have a 25 or 50% loss. That type of strategy gets wiped off the board.
Right,
It just blows up because those options they're writing, which are worth 10 cents on a dollar, start going, becoming worth 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, a dollar on a dollar. And so the position gets larger as the market goes against them.
Right.
What protects those type of strategies is that we haven't had those events. So people got to be very careful. People look, investors are so naive on this point. They think they're being sophisticated. They'll look at return risk and they'll say, the volatility is low and the return is good. So this is a great investment. Not understanding that a lot of times low volatility does not come from low risk. It's simply a matter of somebody selling insurance, and selling insurance looks like low volatility until there's a hurricane.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. So we did see these great returns for years, and many of these hedge fund managers who we thought were like, wow, they knew something. I mean, a great, I think a very good indication of, what's going on here is when we saw this Sun Edison implode recently and recently filed for bankruptcy, and Sun Edison was loved by the hedge funds. It was kind of like, well, we understand this, and you figure, well, these guys are sophisticated. They got big staffs. They know what they're doing, and they buy these stocks. They ride them up, and then the thing implodes, and you wonder, what is it that they not only didn't see, but were they just totally bamboozled, or was it something that it's like, well, they're just really riding a wave here, and their smarts are all about just all these other guys buying in also and just kind of moving this whole thing up regardless of kind of the underlying fundamentals, because it was so convoluted, this whole thing. And the add-on to that is, are we going to see, with all of the new regulations and the transparency and the things that are obviously have been clamped down on with regard to insider trading, are we going to see those kind of returns from these guys in the future?
Well, first of all, I don't know the particular hedge. I can't comment on the particular example you use because I'm not informed there. As far as the increased regulation, I mean, we've had significant regulation before, and insider trading, I don't think is a big issue, really. I mean, in terms of what happens, it's really more a matter of the more competition you have, the more professional the competition, the more money hedge funds are managing, the more difficult it is for them to excel. So there is that element of it. I kind of basically have for a long time used the example, if you took the 100 best traders in the world and only they could trade and they had to trade with each other, the only thing I could tell you is 80% of them would lose because they all have to pay transaction costs. So that's the extreme. But my point is that if professional traders become too large a piece of the pie, then by definition, the majority of them can't win.
Right.
It's the same reason sort of why people are always surprised. They always make the big deal. Mutual funds, mutual funds, 80% of mutual funds don't beat the S&P. Well, of course they don't beat the S&P because together they are the S&P.
Right.
And they're paying costs and they're taking out fees. So how could they possibly, mathematically, it's impossible for them to beat the S&P. It's always written up like it's some sort of surprise.
Yeah, I mean, and especially these days where, listen, I was thinking about how times have changed. You know, in the days before there was the internet and the days before there was the ability for the individual investor to really do the research, or at least have access to the research like we have today, real time, relatively inexpensive, whether it's exactly scrubbed data or not is a different story. But okay, you know, the data is out there and it's available and accessible, to where we kind of went from, okay, you had to go to the library or you had to go somewhere to kind of on a Saturday to look at all the different materials, gather your information, try. It's kind of like a racing form, you know, kind of concept, right. where, you know, and then we kind of catapulted into a period where everybody has access. It kind of took a little bit of the edge off some of this for some of the, the players that had it previously that paid up for the data that was, you know, somehow delivered through a Bloomberg terminal or whatever it may be. But one of the things that you're trying to do, I think, is to then, at this point is to give the smaller guy, more of an opportunity to do a few things with this fund seeder. And the whole idea, well, why don't I ask you, so what was the genesis of this idea, this whole fundseeder.com, fund seeder site and process that you're working on?
Okay, so before I describe it, you know, I should just say, you know, I don't want to take credit here because it wasn't my idea. It was actually my partner's idea, Emmanuel Bellari. And I actually have been working in an advisor for a fund that with his company, and we were at a conference, we're talking, he told me, he pitched this idea to me, and I said, hey, you know, that's not a bad idea. Yeah. And the idea was fund seeder. So the idea basically is to form a central point on the web, basically, that would be the connection between traders worldwide and investors looking for emerging trading talent. And right now, the model that exists is pretty much of a very narrow, curated model. If you come from an Ivy League school and have the right connections and work for the right firm, you know, you might have an opportunity to be able to manage money. But if you don't come from that background, then you could be a good trader. You could just have, you know, basic street smarts, just have a basic skill. You could be in East Europe. You could be somewhere in Asia where you just don't have any access to money. You could be a brilliant quant who comes up with a with a great model, but don't just have no way of raising any money or know any investors or have any tie-in. So there's a whole world out there, and I'm speaking globally, not just U.S., where there are, no matter how small the percent of skilled traders are as a percent of all traders, there are so many traders globally that even if you say a tiny fraction of 1% are really skilled, that's still a ton of people.
Right.
And they have no access to you know, becoming known, to accessing capital or anything else. So the idea of Fundseeder is allow them, create a website where they can come on, put their account on the website. And the difference here with Fundseeder versus most websites, they don't just kind of say, okay, they go in and they put in their numbers and, you know, you hope it's right or whatever. In Fundseeder's case, well, the basic model is they link their account via their brokerage firm. And so the numbers don't come from the traders. They come from the broker and they come daily. So you build real-time track records daily for traders globally, providing them with an opportunity for those that are skilled to demonstrate, hey, they really got some talent here.
Mm-hmm.
And then that becomes a database that can be searched for new emerging talent. And through a separate company, which is Fundseeder Investments, that Fundseeder Investments can use the data, you know, the data collected by Fundseeder to find talented traders and then put them together either in an emerging market fund or to introduce them to qualified investors. And eventually Fundseeder Investments, that website will, right now it's more of a landing spot, but eventually we'll have a subset of traders that will be on that site as well. And they'll be the registered traders and so forth. But that's the basic concept is to democratize and globalize the search for traders and to provide the connecting link between unknown, undiscovered trading talent and investors looking for new traders, and as opposed to everybody investing with the same funds managing $1 billion plus.
It's kind of like Trading Idol or The Voice.
Well, in a way, I guess, yeah. You know, I mean, I never thought of it that way, but yeah, you know, really, yeah. In a way, exactly.
Or maybe like The Voice, you know, you got all these people watching it and then they click the button. Yeah, I want him on my team.
Yeah, exactly. Except, you know, so what's democratized, what's globalized and democratized is the trader side. On the investor side, of course, we're not, for regulatory reasons, you know, you can't just let, you know, anybody on, you know, you can't like, you know, put everybody on and let everybody access. That's why there's a separate Fundseeder Investments where there's like compliance oversight and only the qualified traders have access and stuff like that. But yes, at least as us being judges and investors that we feel qualified being judges, yes, it is like one of those shows where you're looking for undiscovered talent, in this case, trading talent.
Right. We just got to get Brian Sechrest as your front man. So now, in terms of so here you are, you're a gent or a lady who has this perceived talent, and she says, oh, okay, you know, I want to check that out. They go sign up for it. They link an account. Is it? By the way, are there pretty much any brokerage account is available, or is it a
good question? Yeah. Ultimately, that's the goal. I mean, that's the goal. But you know, it's a big project because, unfortunately, if we lived in a world where every broker was where the programming was the same in order to retrieve returns and stuff and retrieve trades was the same, it'd be a lot easier. But you know, different brokers all have their different systems, and you got to get permission from different brokers. So we're building it gradually. So we have, you know, over time we're and it's fairly new, but we are adding brokers all the time. So in certain areas like FX, where we have the MT4 platform, that gets like a ton of FX brokers.
Mm-hmm.
On the future side, we get a lot of brokers. We're working on the equity side to get some more individual brokerage firms, and we have TradeStation, which is a big, you know, another big one. We have Interactive Brokers, which has accounts of all types. So we've got quite a number now. If we don't have your broker on there yet, what people can do is we've got a little template. They can upload their data. Now that becomes listed, therefore it's unverified.
Right.
But it does allow people to put their daily returns up into our software and therefore be able to do neat stuff, which you really can't do anywhere, you know. I don't know if you can do anywhere else, but I don't know where else you can do it. But you can kind of create your own equity curve of your trading. You can then do analysis on that, like underwater charts on that, wherever it dips below a prior high, see what your drawdowns look like on a daily basis. You can do rolling indicators like rolling returns over any time period, rolling Sharpe ratios, rolling gain-to-pain ratios, anything you want. There's all sorts of graphs and analysis you can do on your data, and that's, you know, there's no cost for that. That's part of our enticement to get as many traders to link with us as possible. So the answer to your question is, you know, ideally we'd love to have every major broker on here. We don't yet. We're working towards it. But there are a lot of brokers that are on, and if your own broker isn't on, you can go at least, you can get the same analytics for the moment in the unverified mode. And then when the broker becomes available, you can get it, you know, you can link it to the broker and get it verified.
Now, is there any cost for the average trader to use your software? I mean, how's that work?
Yeah, no, our model right now is completely free. I don't know if we'll stay free forever to the traders, but our thinking was, let's make this as attractive as possible for traders. Let's give them lots of tools, graphs, charts, everything for free. Let them create a track record for free. Not because we're saints or anything like that. It's not, we're not doing this out of kindness to the trading world.
Yeah, naturally.
Our self-interest, and we do have a self-interest. Our self-interest is, hey, the more traders we can get onto the site, the more good traders will be there, the more opportunity there is for us to find traders that are new and undiscovered that we can then create funds around, and then our income would come from the fund seeder investment side, where fund seeder investments would have a good base of traders to create multi-manager funds, and would also be able to create some single manager funds if we find the right traders, and also introduce the appropriate institutional investors to traders that match what they're looking for.
So how long of a track record does somebody need to have before maybe in the future a institutional firm or someone out there would say, hey, you know what, that guy is, he's doing pretty good, and we like his general style, and we see maybe what he's doing. Looking at the track record, how long of a track record does someone need to have before it's looked at as, okay, that's consistent?
Okay, well, there's no like magic number, like 3 years, whatever. One thing I'll say right off the bat is, remember, this track record is different than most track records, or these track records are different than most track records in that they're daily data. Mm-hmm. And that's a big deal. So monthly data can hide a lot of sins. You know, you can have a trader that loses 15% intra-month and then comes back and recovers 12% of it and shows a 3% loss. And you think, oh, okay, he's down 3%. That's not too bad. You don't know that he was intra-month was down 15, or could have been down intra-month 25. So monthly data can hide a lot of sins. You can hide a lot of risk that you otherwise don't see. In daily data, there's no place to hide. So that's one point about daily data. The other point about daily data is there's about 22 times as much of it as there is of monthly data. So you get a lot more statistical verification in terms of doing stuff like return to risk. So if you're looking at like a measure that I like to use, like a gain to pain ratio, which is a return to loss, net return over loss. If you're doing that on daily, you get a lot more meaning out of the statistical meaning than if you did it on monthly data. So that's one point about it. So therefore, you don't need as long a record as you would normally need. The other point is that the track records doesn't necessarily begin just when somebody starts, because we're a new company and we just launched our new platform only about a month and a half ago, and we had a prior sort of different, you know, more skeleton type platform, but the real platform only launched about a month and a half ago, and therefore that's not very long. However, people come onto the site will have, you know, in most cases, have track records going back. Mm-hmm. Depending on the broker, we can import, you know, depending how much of the track record they provide. You know, some, if they provide all of it, we can import all of it. But even if they don't, that track record still exists. So the track records will be of various lengths and can sometimes be longer for people to come on the site. We don't have any predetermined definition. But if you see somebody forming nicely, consistently on daily data for even, you know, a two-year track record, that's enough to take a closer look. So there is no sort of minimum number, though, that we place on it. However, a lot of the people that are already linked to the site do have track records that go back quite a number of years.
You know, I remember there was a few of these that were, I think there was a site called way back when, Marketocracy, and there was another one that began with a C, and I can't remember the name of it. But they basically just tracked your information. I even think that there was some kind of a fee associated with what they did. But the difference here looks like to me is that while you have the trading and analytics and performance-based and confirmations of all that, which may or may not be similar to what they did exactly, but the difference is that you're looking to go next step, which is, okay, guys, you want to be a professional trader, not just see your performance, not just have a reporting platform to see what you're doing, but the potential is that if you're really serious about this and you want to do this in the future, whether you're an individual or possibly even a current advisor, that you can actually then be linked up with the opportunity to do this in a real way with some serious money in the future, where there may be some money that is individually directed to you, or possibly even a fund of funds concept that will be created, or maybe even an ETF around it or something like that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it basically provides an opportunity for people who are skilled at trading to demonstrate it and to get access to money, which they would have no hopes in the world of ever getting otherwise, because they're not part of the small club where that occurs. And that's exactly it. So, and I think it, in that sense, it's disruptive. I mean, FundSeeder will be disruptive if we're successful. You know, if we can grow a lot and it becomes, and everybody kind of says, oh, you're a new trader, you're looking for access, go on FundSeeder. If that becomes sort of the natural mode, then we can sort of bypass a lot of the Wall Street gatekeepers, and then it would become disruptive. So it has the potential to do that. Conceptually, I think the concept is potentially disruptive. It's a question of if we can execute it successfully.
You know, the more I think about it, the more it does remind me of American Idol, because basically you're being judged, and you see what's going on, you go through the process, and then the end of the deal, you get a record deal. It's kind of the same thing.
We have to be picked, but some percentage of traders do get that access.
But that is the point. But that's the point. The interesting thing about the way the world works now, as you mentioned, it is that there is the availability through different methodologies, whether it's the underground economy, like the Ubers, where, you know, how would somebody become a taxi driver? They have to buy a medallion. They have to go through this process. I mean, potentially. And they can actually now just kind of go through the process and do it part-time, if you will, or at least do it in a way that's a much easier way from an administration way to get paid. They don't have to have their own credit card payment process and all that. And this goes on and on, and it's kind of the same thing. It's an adjunct to the concept that there now is the availability to have yourself seen outside the world, not inside your house or office or, you know, your trading room, if you will, because there is now these kinds of things that are available that that make the opportunity so much greater, and it really spreads you from an individual maybe that's just trading on one screen, maybe equities or futures, whatever it is, to now someone who has global reach.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the concept.
Yeah, pretty cool. Well, everybody can check it out over on fundseeder.com. And there's all sorts of information there. I was just checking out a little while ago about that and, you know, kind of next step for, you know, if what happens and how it works and how to get started and set up. One other couple of things I want to kind of jump back to for 1 second. I see that you have two more books seemingly coming out here. It's back the end part of 2016, A Complete Guide to the Futures Market, and also Getting Started in Technical Analysis. Man, you are unbelievable with the books.
Okay. So good homework on your part. You're up on that. The books aren't even out. So both of those books were prior books. They're revisions. In fact, the complete guide to the futures markets, there's a history to that. Most people think that Market Wizards was my first book. It was not. It was The Complete Guide to the Futures Markets, which was written on, I took a sabbatical in 1984, a long time ago, because I thought there wasn't really a good book in the industry on futures, and sort of I did the encyclopedic work on futures analysis, futures market analysis and trading, and so that was like a 750 page book or whatever. About 10 or 12 years later, Wiley talked me into doing an update, and I ended up doing a revision, which was 3 volumes and ended up going almost 2,000 pages. Now I said I would never do it again. However, they want to update a single volume, and I have a co-author, Mark Etzcorn, who I've worked who did get getting started with me. This is the other book you mentioned a number of years ago, and he's kind of the only person I trust to do the updating. And so he's kind of taking a lead on revising the original book and sending me the drafts, and then we're working on it together. Mm-hmm. So that book, yeah. So this is more like a single volume update. I don't know, but it'll probably also run 700, 800 pages. It'll cover just about everything.
Yeah.
From technical analysis, chart analysis, trading systems, performance measurement, trading methodologies, go on and on and on.
Yep.
So that's due for October is the official scheduled publication date.
Mm-hmm.
And getting started is sort of like the short version, the sort of getting dummies version of just the technical analysis portion. It's not as detailed, but it's good for somebody who's just, a beginner and just getting in. The technical portion of the complete guide itself will probably run 300, oh, maybe more than 300, probably more like 400 pages. So, but somebody wants like a shorter introduction to technical ideas and charts. The Getting Started book is kind of aimed for that audience.
Yeah. So after all of this, let's kind of sum up something here. After all of your research with all these market wizards, and I know you told me that everybody has their own thing. I get that. Right. One guy may poo poo the fundamental analysis. Another guy may be like, oh, my God, the technical analysis charts, that's hocus pocus. Somebody else may be like, I only use astrology. Whatever it is, whatever works. Right.
Right.
In the end, after all of this, do you have a favorite type of analysis?
Well, I gravitated to one type of methodology. And so I've discovered for myself that, even though a guy who's developed trading systems, and there was a time in my life I thought I prefer to do trading systems because I don't like the emotionality of trading. But I ultimately came to the realization that I'm not comfortable with trading systems because you got to follow them rigorously. And that sometimes means taking significant drawdowns because you don't know when the next signal is going to come and you have to stick with the system.
Right.
And it sort of doesn't give me as much control as I'd like. And so I've ultimately said, well, I've got to go back to just discretionary. And the other thing is, while I started out, actually everything I do now is not what I did in the beginning, which is interesting. So I started out as a fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. I gravitated to technical, but ultimately systematic. And now I'm sort of discretionary and purely technical and particularly chart oriented. So my own approach, which is what I'm comfortable with, is I use charts to pick trades, and I'm influenced by the traders I interviewed and by what I learned during the books. So for one of the things I do routinely is, let's say I look for a pattern where I think it doesn't have to be conventional. It doesn't have to be simply looking for a breakout and looking for a trend. I could also be doing trades where I think the market's getting to a point where there's going to be a lot of resistance, and I'll sell right into that. It's a counter trend trade. So I'll do that, and I'll also do a trade where it looks like the market's beginning to break out of a bottom and it can have a long trend. So I'll do both trend and counter trend. I have no bias to just doing one or the other. But the idea will come off the charts.
Right.
And whatever the trade is, whether it's trend or a counter trend trade, I decide where, in Bruce Kovner's own words, Bruce Kovner Caxton, I interviewed many years ago, know where you're getting out before you get in.
Mm-hmm.
I follow that advice. What I do is I enter the order to get into the market, and usually it's a market order. Sometimes, not always. I mean, actually, a lot of times I will use limits, but I enter the order to get into the market, wherever it is, the point I want to get in at, along with a stop, good till cancel stop, where I get out.
Mm-hmm.
And so what that does two things for me. Number one, it takes the emotionality, most of the emotionality out of it, because I've made the decision of where I'm getting out. There's nothing more to decide. I have to worry. If the trade doesn't go my way, I'll be taken out with a loss that I predetermined is fine and okay and not a big deal.
Yep.
And so that takes a lot of the stress and emotionality out of it, much more effectively for me, say, than a trading system approach. And the other thing it does, of course, is it builds in rigorous money management. So that's kind of the approach I use. And the other big element I personally have come to use, and I kind of go through phases where I trade and I don't trade now. For the last number of months, for about 3-4 months now, I've been trading almost on a daily basis, which is not usual for me. I mean, good, but I've been doing that. It depends how much time I have, how occupied I am, and with other projects. But what I always do is whenever I start trading again, I mean, I go through periods where I've got other things going, I don't have time, I'm not in the mood, I'm not trading at all. But whenever I start trading, what I always do is I kind of start with a small amount. I will limit my amount. And once I get ahead, then I'll start trading more. But I always know that whatever I'm going to lose on any attempt is going to be no big deal if I lose. So that's also a comforting factor. And I kind of would advise that as a pretty good approach for anybody is just start out with, when you start out trading, decide how much you're willing to, how much you can lose without it being a big deal in your life. And if you get to that point, liquidate everything, go away, come back in a few months or whenever you're in the mood and start again. But that sort of prevents you from losing a lot of money at any given point.
Good advice. Excellent, excellent advice. Well, Jack Schwager, will make sure to put all the links on how to get to the various places, your books, and obviously fundseeder.com, how to check that out. And hopefully, I wish you the best of luck with that. It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Oh, I should say one more thing, Henry, before we go.
Yep.
This may entice some people not. We talked about books and we talked about Fundseeder. There's actually a link between the two. My intention is that a couple of years from now, I will be using the Fundseeder database to kind of select a group of traders who are really good. And tentatively, I've got a working title for this book. The concept is Undiscovered Market Wizards.
Oh, wow.
So, so people not only have a chance to get some access to money, but if they're good, they actually might end up being in a future market wizard book.
I think you should maybe reconsider it and call it Fund Idols. I'm just saying. with an upfront from Kelly Clarkson or something. Anyway, hey, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks a lot, Andrew.
Anyway, check that out. I think there's some interesting things there that you'll find. I thought it was kind of interesting overall to see the work that he's doing there and the opportunity that he's giving people actually to maybe reach their dreams if they are dreaming of being an investment guru, somebody who maybe is either managing money or even to get a better understanding of your own trading. That's really the whole point there. It can be very worthwhile for you. Before we got to Jack, I mentioned that we have some questions. By the way, anything that you want to know about Jack and the information that he has on the disciplinedinvestor.com website over on the show notes for this particular show. And you can find out all that information and links, etc. But again, we have a couple questions that came in. You can always send me your questions at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We don't always get to them on the show, but I try to answer you at least in a response directly if I can. But I had a couple that I thought were interesting. This is from Ron from Rapid City. He said, you know, I have quite a bit of money in a retirement account, about 50-50 in shorter-term bonds and stocks, mostly in the S&P 500. So I have a couple of questions that you would hopefully answer. It'd be good to hear you discuss on your podcast. He said, if I shift my money out of stocks, are tips a viable options to bonds? Or are bonds still generally recognized option? The second thing is, given the minimal difference in return between short and long-term bonds, does it make sense to invest in long-term bonds? All right, let's start with the first thing. So Ron, here's the first discussion. First of all, if you're shifting your money out of stocks, so what you're saying to me here is that you're thinking about taking your money, for whatever reason that is, that you're taking your money out and you want to know of an alternative. Now, the big question you have to ask yourself is, if you're going to take your money out of stocks, is there going to be a time that you're going to be moving them back, or is this something that's going to be more of a permanent move? Maybe you're doing it because you just don't want the risk and you want to retire off of the income that's generated from your portfolio and you just don't want to have any of the ups and downs with stocks. Whether or not from a academic standpoint, we could say whether that's right or wrong, we're not getting there. We're just talking about your question here because it's something that obviously needs some further discussion and some thought by you to wonder about whether or not you're going to hold any equities or not. But I think the question really is about tips versus bonds. Now, tips. Tips are Treasury inflation-protected securities. Essentially, what these are they're bonds issued by the government that will actually pay you a bonus, we'll call it, dependent on the inflation rate. Right now, it's zero, right? There's really no inflation out there. But it looks like, all things being considered, unless something really is going to be breaking down here, that inflation is not too far away. Now, is it massive inflation, runaway inflation, hyperinflation? No. But some inflation. We haven't had inflation in years of any reasonable amount. None. And with the latest move of oil and commodities lower, well, real inflation is just nowhere to be found, at least from the statistical information that we are getting from the government. And that's what tips are based on, their actual read on inflation. Now, are tips a viable instrument? Yes. As a matter of fact, we've moved some decent amount of money from our portfolios for our clients that are with our global allocation into tips from shorter duration and mid-duration bonds. Now, again, you're talking about moving them from stocks, and the question is, do I move it out of stocks into stocks or bonds, into tips or bonds? So if you want to use tips as a proxy for your bond exposure, very good way to do so for a portion of the portfolio. Now, the second question we'll answer at the same time here, because I think it relates. You said, again, given the minimal difference in return between stock and long-term. All right, let's start again. Given the minimal difference in return between short and long-term bonds, does it make sense to invest in long-term bonds? I don't think it makes sense at all. Right now, if you understand skew, if you understand the potential of higher and longer duration bonds to be susceptible to market risk if interest rates move higher, even though those are pretty tightly aligned with the shorter bonds right now in terms of rates, the fact of the matter is that the longer bond should have a much greater overall interest rate. A lot of this is artificial, being pressed down by the Fed for all the reasons that we've talked about. They are continuing to buy bonds on a regular basis as part of the continuing quantitative easing program by reinvesting the interest as well as reinvesting the principal that comes due on the bonds that they have outstanding. So I think that because of that, and there is supposedly an end in sight, maybe a few years down the road, but still an end in sight for the overall excessive amount of bond purchases that they've been doing. And they've said that themselves, which whether we want to believe it or not, that's what they're telling us. That being the case, I think, yes, tips and shorter-term bonds are a very important area that you need to look at, and something that probably should have an overweighting in your overall bond exposure, fixed income exposure from your portfolio. Now, again, we're just talking about those couple of things answering your question. There's probably a lot more that goes into this in terms of the actual asset allocation, diversification of your portfolio, your time frame, your tax situation, you know, a lot of different things that go into this discussion for anybody that's listening to this. And Ron, I'll tell you the same thing, that probably there's a lot more that you should really be looking at in terms of this, and looking at, you know, what really is the big end game plan here for your portfolio. JC wrote, he's in, JC in Pennsylvania. He writes, thanks for a great show. Question for you. I have been reading about the free app based on free app based brokers. What does that mean? I have been reading about the free apps. Oh, the app based brokers. What he's saying to me is, there's all these apps that are out there, the Robinhood app and all these different apps and different companies out there that you can get free brokerage for your stock trading, ETF trading, etc. Is it really free, and is it something I should be looking at? That's what JC is asking. I'll tell you, you're going to get what you pay for to a degree. They're getting paid somehow. They're not being altruistic here. Okay? It may be beneficial for someone who's just buying a stock or an ETF or some investment with a long-term hold. It's probably not for the day trader. The execution on the actual transaction probably isn't as good as some of the other brokers that specialize in very quick, accurate, and excellent exposure for their transactions in order to give you a good execution price that is close to current market price. So there's probably give and take here. I'd probably say that, again, if the $7 per trade is a problem for you at most of the brokers out there, and you want to have a free trading account, and you're thinking about buying something that you'll hold for some time, I don't think there's a problem with that. On the other hand, if you're buying something that you're holding for a period of time, what's the difference about spending $7 to buy it in a trade? I'm kind of not really very excited about these kinds of gimmicks, if you will. I think still there's something to be said about the service and platforms you get when you're looking at some more of the traditional style of brokerages out there. But again, maybe not the worst thing in the world. Anyway, if you have questions, and thanks for your question, JC. If you have questions, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Check out the things we have to offer over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can see how to follow me on Twitter, for example, some of the other podcasts that we do over DH Unplugged, et cetera, and a whole host of other things. With that, we're going to close it up, and I hope you enjoyed the show today. I thought it was great with Jack Schwager, and next week we have another great guest, and we're coming at you next week talking about markets and some of the things that we saw this week in terms of that are coming up on markets, earnings, economics, maybe a few little ideas for you there. Thanks again. I'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.